I'm now going to talk about our first speaker today. There's two speakers today talking about piracy. Nicholas Frickman is from the University of Pittsburgh and very kindly came over last year and gave an excellent talk on fleet mutinies and mutinies in the British Navy in the 1790s. It was an excellent talk. And Nicholas has spent a week with us this year and I think he's had a good time. So maybe you'll elaborate on that later. But we've had a good time, so I'm just going to sit down and shut up.
Hello, everyone. I first of all would like to thank the organizers and or the Bristol Radical History Mob, and it's been a great pleasure to have been here last year and to have come back. I needed to be battered into it a little bit, but I'm very, very glad they put up the effort to make me come back, because it's been a great week, a lot of fun, and even more importantly, I've learned a lot and met a lot of very nice people. The topic of my talk today, the questions first came to me while I was researching smuggling gangs in Sussex a few years ago. And as I was learning about these gangs, it struck me that a lot of things I learned were very reminiscent of the pirate crews I'd read about in books by Marcus and other historians. The sort of similarities I'm thinking about are things like the way they organized themselves in gangs were very reminiscent of the pirate crews. So they would elect leaders. They wouldn't have a permanent leader who made the decisions. They would call meetings and then appoint someone who seemed suitable for the position. If there were weighty matters to be decided upon, they would call a council and decide together what was to be done. When they made profits, they would share them, not according to sort of highly stratified economies they were used at, but according to shares. Presumably, but this is very hard to prove in the case of the smugglers, they drew on old maritime traditions of sharing the profits of the voyages. But in any case, where exactly it came from is hard to know, but that's what they did do. They did share their profits. Another similarity that struck me very strongly was the social makeup of these gangs, and I should emphasize that I'm speaking only about smuggling gangs in the southeast. So this would be Kent and Sussex, specifically from the upland region of the Weald. These were not, as in some other regions of England, gangs that were basically simply the local people. Like pretty much everyone who was local was involved in smuggling in some regions. We heard Kev speak about the southwest earlier this week, and it appears to be the case that that was the way it worked there. In the Weald, it tended to be dispossessed commoners. The demographics of the region was that because it was upland, it was open parishes, a lot of commoners had been thrown off the land in other regions in England, moved there. And it was these types of people who then went into smuggling. So you can choose to call them proletarians. It's a contentious issue whether these social categories that only really become meaningful in the 19th century do apply to the 18th century. Nevertheless, they shared a lot of those characteristics. They were landless, they didn't really have much capital. What they had was their skills and their labor power. So, and then again, this is something they shared with sailors that turned pirate. Another similarity along those lines is that the Weald, because it was an upland region, had tended to foster a kind of general spirit of independence and liberty. These were people who lived in communities where there weren't many landlords or state churches. They didn't really like people to tell them what to do. We know from studies of sailors that there was a very similar situation there. These were very independent-minded people. They were people who would go onto the streets in the age of revolution and attack governments. They played an enormously important role in the American Revolution, for example. So you have a similar sort of spirit of rebelliousness in the Weald. Also, it's from back in the mid-17th century, it was a center of radical Protestantism. another similarity, like the list is a bit long, I know, but this is where these ideas come from, these ideas that I have, is the location. Pirates flourished in the Caribbean, of course, and later when the Caribbean became too hot for them, they moved to African coast and onto the Indian Ocean. So there were regions where empires did not really exert much authority and power. Again, similar situation in the wheel. The British state government had very, very weak authority in this region, partly again because of it was upland forest area. This is not an area you easily dominate. Finally, perhaps the most striking similarity that came to me was that both groups came into an incredibly violent conflict with the state that in both cases ended with scores of men being strung up in gallows, very much like the news hanging back here. And they were then distributed in gibbets. Their rotting bodies were distributed in gibbets as a warning to all others. These were spread out to places where potential followers of their path would see them, on beaches, for example, all over Sussex, important roads. In the case of the pirates, of course, they would be spread out all across the ports of the Atlantic. So it occurred to me that something's going on here. These are two groups who live in very, very different places, but there are a lot of similarities. So what I want to do today is to think a little bit about how can we think about them as one phenomenon. What kind of historical phenomenon are they? Why do we have these groups that pop up at seemingly different places at approximately the same time, and then they go on to develop, to look very, very similarly? So that's some of the ideas I want to think about today. One traditional way groups like these have been thought about is with the concept of social crime. There was an enormous explosion of crime in the 17th and especially in the 18th century. At the same time, there was a recognition that the broad populace did not really find most of these activities particularly criminal. So there was a disconnect between what was legal and what was popularly considered to be legitimate. These sort of activities were often linked to recent enclosures. So a classic example, for example, would be poaching. A particular community has been hunting in a particular forest for generations. This forest is now enclosed, and all of a sudden, to go hunting is called to go poaching, and you will get the death penalty for it. People did not recognize that that was a crime. You can also think about, as we heard in a talk earlier this week, about present-day smuggling. I don't think anyone here or pretty much anywhere really rejects smuggling on principle. People might not like it if it's like arms smuggling or drug smuggling or a humongous scale, but on principle no one really rejects it. Same with tax evasion. Like, everyone fiddles with their taxes and doesn't really consider that to be a bad thing. That's the sort of crimes people think about when they speak about social crime. Obviously, this expresses a certain kind of sentiment, but there are problems to determine that sentiment. It's not as easy to figure out what people thought 300 years ago. But the bigger problem with this concept, this notion of social crime, is that it doesn't really tell us why people committed the crimes. It's all very well that your grandparents have gone hunting in a certain forest, and you feel you have a right to do that. But if you get the death penalty for doing it, just some sort of attachment to traditional ways of doing things is not really an adequate explanation. A second problem with the notion of social crime is that there was a general explosion in crimes in the 18th century. A lot of them were not in any way, or could not in any way fall under the definition of social crime. Things like housebreaking, pickpocketing, highway robbery. No one really considered that as legitimate activity, yet there was a massive, massive explosion in these sort of crimes. So I think the first thing that we need to do is think a little bit about where crime in the 18th century came from. Why was there such a mass expansion of criminal activity? Why did people become criminals in such vast masses? And then as a second question, given that there is such a diversification of crime, an expansion of crime, why did matters come to such an explosion around piracy and smuggling. So those are the two questions I want to address. As for crime in the 18th century, the most immediate and easiest answer for expansion of crime is there were a lot more crimes. That is to say, laws were passed constantly to expand the criminal statute book. And it's been estimated that there was the number of capital statutes went from around 50 to around 200 in the 18th century. So there were 200 crimes you could get the death penalty for all of a sudden. Most of these crimes were linked to enclosure. So there were things like poaching. They were to protect newly created private property. This was part of a massive, massive movement of redistributing societal wealth upward on the social scale. These forests, heathlands, commons were held in common before. Now they were private property. Obviously, that meant taking property from the poor and giving it to the already rich. Even more importantly, perhaps, is that this was not simply an abolition of rights. It was that too, but more importantly, it was a criminalization, an outlawing of the way poor people maintained their lives. The commons were not a sort of this happy never-never land place. The commons were essential for survival. People got wood from there, they got reed for basket making or for their roofs, they got herbs there for medicines, they had rights to pasture their animals there, they hunted there, they fished there, and so forth. These were absolutely essential economic activities for people to survive. So in fact, what that meant, once all these criminal statutes were passed and criminalizing all these activities, was basically they outlawed all reproductive activity except for wage labor. It was open season on all non-wage laborers. In effect, that meant a whole class of people was outlawed, criminalized. Now, the big problem with that was that it would have been not fine, but there would have been far less misery and resistance had there been enough wage-paying jobs to absorb this enormous population that was suddenly thrown off the land. But that wasn't the case. These people were thrown off the land, but not given any opportunities to find work. So, one idea that I have learned from the many-headed Hydra is that there was a great, great time lag between what Marcus and Peter call the process of expropriation. The land of the people was taken from them, and it was a time lag between that process to the process of exploitation, when they were beginning to be exploited as wage laborers in the factories. This is, E.P. Thompson called this the great arch of English history, and it stretches for several centuries of early modern English history, where people had to find some way of living, because they weren't allowed to go on the commons anymore, but they weren't given an opportunity to earn a wage either. So they had to be creative, and they had to live in illegality largely, and come up with ways of simply surviving. In some region and at some times, smuggling and piracy became these ways. So the important thing, I think, which this perspective is different than social crime perspective, is that these are new kind of activities. People are forced by necessity to come up with ways of surviving. This is not simply carrying on old ways of doing things in rural England. This is a new way of surviving. Okay, so this is the overall context of the explosion of crime in the 18th century. Now, the question of why smuggling and why piracy, why did that lead to such an incredibly violent conflict? And I think to understand that, one has to think about the people who did the executing, the state. Why did the state attack these groups? And to understand that, I think one has to take into account that all across 17th century Europe, there was an incredible crisis. Prior to that, the economy generally expanded, and now suddenly you had economic contraction. There's a number of reasons for that, and it's a still very contested issue trying to resolve the exact causes, but the general outlines are very clear. As Sylvia also pointed out in her talk, prices rose dramatically. The price of grains and other foodstuffs rose to swindle-inducing heights. What made this even worse was that we have what is called the Little Ice Age. Temperatures across Europe dropped, leading to smaller harvests, obviously again leading to higher prices. What that in turn caused was mass starvation all across Europe. England is very different for some reason, that again are contested. But English population continued to grow throughout the 17th century. That wasn't the case in Europe. Overall population stagnated and even declined in places. It was that bad. Undernourished populations obviously are open for all sorts of epidemics. Plague and especially dysentery ripped through Europe. All this, such situations obviously not entirely free of social tension. And in fact, you had social revolts all the time. The most extreme example I know is the Provence in southern France, where between 1596 and 1715, and this is a region of about 600,000 people at the time, and in this span of 119 years, you had 374 peasant insurrections. So it's this level of social tension. And not enough with that. It's not simply big riots. You also have regime-shaking insurrections all across Europe. Obviously, I don't need to tell anyone here about the revolts in England, the English Revolution and civil wars. But you have the same thing in the Low Countries, in France, Catalonia, Portugal, Sweden, Bohemia, Bavaria, and Naples. Serious insurrections that shake and overthrow regimes. It is against this background of universal social and economic crisis in Europe. Oh, and I should also add a further important factor. These crises contributed and were reinforced by massive wars. Most dramatically, the 30 Years' War, which raged from 1618 to 1648. It is unbelievable the sort of damage these wars did, especially to Germany and the land surrounding it. There was nothing in Central Europe for the next 300 years that approached the damage and misery and deaths these wars caused. So this was the situation on the European continent for much of the middle of the 17th century. And it's only against the background of this universal crisis that one can understand where the British mercantile state came from. A number of countries, France, the Netherlands, but above all England, reacted to this crisis by constructing mercantile states that looked away from Europe for economic growth. Now, mercantilism has had very bad press, especially since Adam Smith, who considered this as undue state interference in the economy. But when policymakers in the 17th century looked to the continent and saw a contracting economy, to them it made sense that the overall economy is like a zero-sum game. Whatever France gains, Britain must lose. Whatever Britain wins, Spain loses. So there's no sense of a constantly growing economy as we have it today. For them, it was one pie. If that is the way you experience the economy, it makes a great deal of sense for policymakers and rulers to build a state which is highly militarized and then use that state to begin conquering external territories and markets so as to use these to benefit the home economy and to make sure that none of your competitors reach these markets and territories. And that is the basic idea of mercantilism. In practice, that meant in the middle of the 17th century that you go to the West Indies and start conquering islands. And then you develop a slave trade to build a plantation economy. And in England, of course, this process started in earnest in the 1650s with Cromwell's Western Design. Now, you don't build a mercantile empire just like that. It's not a very easy process to go through. Especially, you have two requirements or two obstacles that you need to overcome. First of all, you have to be able to control the colonial populations. I mean, it's no good if you conquer an island, you bring slaves there, you bring credit there, you put transportation infrastructure in place, and then these pesky colonials trade with the French. That's not going to benefit the British economy. So you have to make sure that your colonial populations will only trade with you. The second requirement that has to be met is that the shipping lanes are secure. Again, it doesn't help you if you put this whole system in place and only when the ships leave Jamaica, enemy privateers or pirates come and take them. The whole system breaks down. Now, late 17th century Caribbean was not a place where those requirements were met. It was a place of enormous chaos. Part of the reason for that is that pretty much since the Spanish first showed up in the New World and instituted a plunder economy, that plunder economy had pretty much been the blueprint. In essence, the Spanish plundered the native population, and then the other European powers, the English, French, Dutch, Portuguese, plundered the Spanish and each other. That was all very well once the sort of overall pile to be plundered kept growing, but that was no longer the case in the 17th century. Secondly, this sort of plunder economy that had prevailed for a good 150 years bred up a population of so-called buccaneers. These were largely former sailors and soldiers, deserters, runaway servants, runaway slaves, who gathered in very small communities all across the Caribbean basin. And they followed a variety of traits. Their name, buccaneer, comes from this, the same word that has led to the modern word barbecue. They cured pork. They hunted pork and cured it with a special technique of they smoked it. And then they sold that to merchant ships that were going back to Europe that needed provision. So that's where the name buccaneer comes from. I think it's French, boucan, is that correct? But they also raided occasionally when ships went by. So they combined economic activities. Sometimes they sold pork, sometimes they stole from them. These sort of populations, again, are highly independent-minded. You don't easily tell them that from now on you only trade with us. So these populations have to be subdued. Well, the problem was that these populations got an enormous infusion of new manpower in the late 17th century. Once the major wars in Europe wound down, there were a lot of mercenaries around who didn't really feel like putting down the gun. So they went beyond the line and continued the war. And this is when you get people who can only be described as sociopaths, like Henry Morgan or François Ollonet, who led vast, vast buccaneer armies against the Spanish mainland cities. If you read the description of when they sacked places like Veracruz or Panama, the kind of brutality is staggering. This is a moment of intense chaos and violence in the Caribbean. And this process is being made much, much worse by the fact that both France and Britain are trying to move in and take over the hegemonic role from the Spanish Empire. So these international conflicts, they fire these other private conflicts that are raging at the same moment. So this is a very, very difficult moment to implement these mercantile plans of building a colonial empire. Well, the hegemonic transition leads into the cycle of war from 1689 to 1714, the combined wars of the Nine Years' War, followed by the War of Spanish Succession. The outcome of the war is very beneficial to Britain. Britain is one of the undisputed victors. The international state system is finally pacified, relatively pacified. There are small wars continuing to rage, but nothing major, and it's very stabilized. At the same time, the wars were incredibly expensive for Britain. Britain comes out of the war with an enormous debt. However, they now have built up their colonial empire. So there's an incredible urge and an eagerness to finally benefit from this mercantile empire that they've been building for a good 75 years. However, and this is something Marx will speak at much greater length in his talk later on this afternoon, so I'm only going to touch upon it. For the demobilization of the war threw hundreds of thousands of seamen onto the labor market. A lot of these people had known war for 25 years. That was their métier. They were seaborne warriors. Now suddenly they found themselves unemployed. These merchant captains, the mercantile elites, who now wanted to very eagerly profit from their empire, they thought that obviously was a great opportunity to press down wages and exploit this maritime labor. But it wasn't as easy as that. And I'm now really pushing it together. Marx will speak much more about this. But in essence, this vast population of unemployed ex-seaborne warriors turned to piracy. They presumably experienced their sudden unemployment and the attack on their wages as a kind of declaration of class war by the mercantile elite, and they were very glad to take up the challenge. So what they did was they went in full-on confrontation against the mercantile system, and they started attacking British, French, Dutch, European commerce, and they did it at such a scale that at this moment, when British commerce should be booming after 25 years of war and Britain victorious, it stagnated. So they built an independent economic system that latched onto this mercantile commodity circuit, and they seriously slowed it down. With a massive national debt weighing on the British government, this was a problem. And I think this is what explains the intensity with which the British state came down on the pirates. After an intense and brutal war, the British state was successful. By the late 20s, Atlantic piracy was largely stamped out as a serious problem. However, the problems did not end for the state. Only a decade later, in the 1730s, the next major problem arose, and that was smugglers in the metropolis, and specifically smugglers in the southeast in Kent and Sussex. Now the problem here was, to build and maintain a mercantile empire requires an enormous amount of financial resources. It wasn't just that they'd build up a debt in the war, it was also to maintain the system. And the main problem here was that what has later become known as Britain's Blue Water Policy. Unlike some other European powers, the British government decided very early on a process of naval expansion. Britain virtually ignored its army. They decided that if they needed armies, they would rent mercenaries or fight proxy wars. What they were going to do was dominate the seas. Now, to build up a navy requires enormous resources. Just to give you an idea of the amount of capital that is involved, by 1800, and this obviously is a good time later, but by 1800, the ships of the Royal Navy alone, so only the ships, not the dockyards, not the docks, not warehouses, other buildings, spare parts, all that is excluded, only the ships, they represented more fixed capital than all textile mills in the West Riding taken together. Another sort of very impressive statistic that always gets me: to build one of these textile mills required approximately £1,600. To keep the first-rate ship of the line simply seaworthy required about £13,000 a year. These were the enormous amounts of money that were involved. These were, to build this navy was a massive undertaking. It required the establishment of vast naval dockyards. In these dockyards, up to 2,000 people worked together. This was unheard of in the 18th century, at least 18th century Europe. There were hardly any private employers that had employees in the hundreds, let alone in the thousands. These naval dockyards required an enormous amount of timber, obviously, that was brought in from both the Baltic and from the American colonies, an enormous amount of iron for nails, for guns, for cannonballs, It required an enormous amount of hemp for rope. They needed thousands and thousands of miles of rope, obviously. They needed acres of sails. Someone had to produce all this. They needed whole oceans of beer and mountains of salt beef to feed the sailors. During wartime, there were a good 100,000 men in the Navy. These people had to be fed three times a day, or actually two times a day. All this basically had enormous economic knock-on effects. British manufacturers received an enormous boost, an enormous state-paid subsidy in the 18th century, as did, of course, merchants and anyone involved in overseas trade, insurers, bankers, slave traders, ship owners, because the ships of the Royal Navy obviously protected their enterprise. Eisenhower is famous for coining the term military-industrial complex for the 1950s American war economy. That was a joke to 18th century Britain. Across the whole century, the British state never spent less than 83% of its overall budget on direct and indirect military spending. It never went below 83%, and at times it went as high as 92%. Like, this was a military-industrial state if ever there was one. Of course, someone had to pay for it. Merchants, manufacturers, they benefited. But the money that the state paid them had to come from somewhere. And this really, I think, is where the genius of the British, or the first British Empire at least, lies. It built an incredible tax system. The real burden on the British economy, the real tax burden, the tax burden in real terms, sorry, on the British economy grew between 1660 and 1815 by a factor of 18. A different way of putting that, the average English taxpayer in 1815 paid 18 times as many taxes as is her equivalent in 1660. Now, the question, of course, was who was to pay these taxes? The most obvious people, the so-called moneyed interests or landed interests, the ones who actually had money to tax, it was a bit pointless going after them. The whole point of the mercantile system was to make the wealthy even wealthier, so it doesn't really make much sense to tax the merchants in order to make the merchants wealthy. However, they were the only ones who really had money to tax. 17th and early 18th century England was only a very semi-monetized society, which is to say, the vast amount of economic activity did not involve money. A lot of people had barter relations, so a shoemaker would exchange shoes with a cider maker, for example, or anyone who had a skill, basically, would use that to trade with other people who had a skill. Another way was the commons, where they still existed, provided an enormous amount of economic activity that had nothing to do with money. So it was very hard to tax people because they didn't have any money to tax. The alternative to taxing people, of course, is to tax goods. Here you can tax goods in two ways. There's the customs. Whenever goods cross the border, that's a traditional way of taxing goods. But again, that was a bit of a tricky thing. The whole idea of the mercantile system was to further commerce. So if you raise customs duties, that's not going to encourage it. The other thing, and that was frankly recognized by British governments, that pretty much at the same rate that you raise customs duties, you're going to increase smuggling. This was very much considered as sort of natural way of things, which it is. I mean, it's logical. That only leaves the excise. You tax goods and services within the country. And this is, in fact, where the vast, vast majority of government income came from in the 18th century. They built an enormous excise system. Most people in England had nothing to do with the state in the 17th century. In the 18th century, almost every village had an excise officer who like snooped around and demanded their money. This was a major, major change. Now, the fact that the excise system became so important goes a long way to explaining why the smuggling that developed in the southeast became such a problem in the 1730s and 40s. And there's a number of reasons for that. First, smuggling in the 1730s and 40s was import smuggling. The same people or their ancestors had also been smugglers, but they had been export smugglers. They'd taken wool from places like Romney Marsh and brought it across the continent because they got a better price there. Now they were import smugglers, and what they imported was tea, a completely new commodity. In the context of this semi-monetized society, where there aren't that many exchanges that involve money, if people start smuggling tea on a large scale, that's a problem for the government, because this is clearly something that needs to have money. It's a commodity that comes from the outside and someone wants money for it. And then I should add that the scale on which they conducted this tea smuggling was enormous. Modern economic historians have estimated that the smugglers brought in about three times as much tea as the East India Company, which was the only legal trader in tea in England. Three times as much. A further problem was that from an economic perspective, from the taxman's perspective, or from any businessman's perspective, tea is an ideal commodity because it is a drug. Like, people just want more of it, and the sort of modern English obsession with a nice cup of tea, that came from the 18th century. There's descriptions of people binging on tea. I mean, they weren't used to caffeine. Our bodies are all used to it. They weren't. They were like drinking tea all afternoon, running around really excitedly, and then went home and had a bad conscience and wrote about it. Then there's a glorious diary by a shopkeeper in Sussex called Thomas Turner, who agonizes about this. He's like boozing tea all afternoon with his friends, and then he goes home at night and has a really bad conscience for being so luxurious and spendthrift, so he just writes these agonizing confessions. It's pretty funny. But it wasn't just people, it wasn't just shopkeepers, and it wasn't just fun, this expansion of the what was essentially a drug economy. This was a period where the average calorific intake of English poor went down. And the reason why they took the tea with a vengeance is because caffeine acts as an appetite suppressant. If you then add the sugar that the West Indian slaves produced and that came together with the tea in the cup, you get a nice shot of completely empty calories. It keeps you going, but it malnourishes you. But obviously, if you're a poor person with not enough access to good food, it's a very attractive beverage to take. So tea was expanding massively, and it was dominated by the smugglers. This was a huge area of economic activity that completely escaped the taxman. Further problem was that the people who did benefit from this smuggling economy were continental trading companies. The smugglers didn't go to China to get the tea. They were on the continent, were trading companies who were set up with the sole purpose to supply British smugglers. There were ships going from Ostend, from Gothenburg, from Flushing, go all the way to Canton just to get tea for the English smugglers. It was organized on such a high scale. Again, this was something the East India Company and the British state lost out on. Finally, a further problem with this smuggling economy was that, unlike in the West Indies, where British merchants and industrialists and capitalists had control over production, they also owned the plantations, in effect. So they could produce a profit by pressing down the conditions of slaves, by using slaves in the first place, and then by treating them very dreadfully. That all lowered production costs. In Asia, they didn't have that luxury. Until the 1730s, European merchants were even allowed to trade directly with the Chinese. They had no way of dictating the price of the commodities they bought. So the only way they could make money one on buying commodities in Asia, bringing them back to England, was through circulation, through selling it. But again, that's something that the smugglers spoiled. In fact, in the 1740s, the London warehouse of the East India Company were filled to the rafters with tea. They couldn't find anyone to buy it because it was too expensive. The smugglers had completely undersold them. So again, similarly as with the pirates, you have here with these smugglers a group of people who quite violently, and these smugglers, they didn't go out and look for trouble, but if riding officers whoever came, they would fight back and defend their trade, as Kevin taught us on Tuesday, I believe. These people were ready to militarily defend their activities, and there's many cases where they fought off riding officers and were victorious. So again, you have a group of people, and these are people who have been previously dispossessed, who latch on to the new world economy, to the capital and commodity source of the new world economy, latch on to that and extract capital that they then use to create lives that they consider worth living, and they create lives that are far different from either what they'd known before in the sort of hierarchies of feudal England, to put it that way. But it's also very different from the sort of strange equality of wage labor, where everyone has been down-leveled and everyone exists in misery. They built something different by violently latching on. They built their own economic system. But again, it was an action which brought them into direct conflict with the British state and harmed the British economy very, very significantly. And again, I think this is the reason why, in the case of the smugglers, the conflict became so brutal. Because, as I mentioned, the context was, if they didn't have taxes, the British Empire could not build its armed force. And if it could not build its armed force, it would be crushed by its competitors. So this was the context. And I think, I want to just conclude by saying, therefore, that I think we often think of smugglers and pirates, we all like them, we love them. But I think we often don't quite realize that these people, these historical phenomena, if you want to call them that, were significant threats. They were not marginal events in the history of Britain or in the history of the British Empire, but they were serious, serious obstacles to its development. They were serious threats of different ways of living. And I think it's important to recall that it's not simply a sort of, we don't just have an antiquarian interest in it. We also have an interest in it as people have tried to go against the empire and build something new. Thank you.
Yeah, he's gone.
You touched on the smuggling thing about the siege, right? What were they smuggling before the siege, right?
Before that, it was mainly, first of all, it didn't happen on that scale. It was what they were calling owling, which was to take wool to the continent. That was largely what they did. Smuggling wasn't a big thing before then. In some other regions, like in Scotland, there was very large-scale tobacco smuggling, but that didn't really happen in the south. And they also, like Kev was saying earlier in the week, they did also take cargoes of brandy, but mainly gin. But the key commodity was tea.
One of the things with Scotland and tobacco was when Scotland became unified with England, there's a massive influx of tobacco into England from Scotland. This huge amount, it just undercut the price of tobacco in England. Right.
Oh, well, you'd have liked Jim's talk then on Sunday, which was about tobacco growing in Gloucestershire and down there. Oh, yeah, I'm sure he'll give you his handout. Come to see you afterwards, I'll give you his handout. Next question.
I don't really know much about what kind of oppression the pirates faced. You mentioned it in passing, that they faced some kind of massive breach of the fashion. I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about that and what happened, what weapons or whatever, what strategies were deployed against the pirates.
I'll be very, very brief because Marcus will, if you're still going to be here, then Marcus will tell you everything about it. But mainly it was a massive deployment of the Navy and of other authorities to the different colonies where the pirates traded their goods, and instituting a far harsher legislation and then mass executions. Like there are instances where dozens of men are executed at once and then just hung in gibbets along the port just to scare other sailors away from turning pirate. So there was an immediate attack on the pirates themselves and killing them, but then it was also a very conscious deployment of terror to scare anyone else off from following that path. And the same principle was essentially applied with smugglers in Sussex, though on a far smaller scale. In Sussex and Kent, about 50 smugglers were executed in total, which is obviously a lot of people. And again, it was mainly in three bouts of mass executions. But that doesn't anywhere near approach the number of pirates who were executed.
When they also offered land as an inducement, because the shortage of labour after intensive labour dried up, weren't they also offered land to work in the colonies?
To my knowledge, they weren't directly offered land. They were offered pardons. And some sort of famous pirate captains, they then turned into very successful pirate hunters. Most sort of common Joe pirates, they seem to have tended to gone in, accepted the pardon, wiped the slate clean, and then like gone out and started a pirate thing again. But the land issue, I don't know, maybe... No.
Yeah, I think there were.
Okay.
There were certain proclamations.
Okay. I mean, there might have been an idea that if you give them land, you draw them away from the sea, and obviously if they're sea, they can't help themselves but make trouble, so we send them as far inland as possible, but I don't know.
Yes,
why
pirates were enemy of the state because of the threat they faced to commerce. Do you think if we all became modern-day pirates, we could enter into capitalist economy?
Absolutely. I mean, there is modern-day piracy. Places like South China Sea and East African coast. I don't know enough about how much damage that actually does. But from what I understand, there's quite a substantial, you may call it, shadow economy of where they take old ships and just bring them into some little used port, but...
Who's going?
I was interested in thinking about the similarity to modern illegal drug smuggling, the whole thing about illegal drugs now. I don't know if you've got any comments on that, but I thought there was interesting parallels, well, differences, but certainly interesting parallels. I mean, the ferocity of the sentence, the sort of social crime aspect of it, what you were said about tea, I thought was interesting. Yeah, lots of interesting relations with that. And also the sort of, I mean, like the way that it just interested me the way that nowadays people are pirates are great, but like heroin smuggling is like absolutely awful. I mean, it sort of troubled me a bit. People said how wonderful being a pirate is, but at the same time, they're very, very, we'll just go along with conventional popular ideas that are currently about smuggling on these days. That makes any sense.
I think I underemphasize this these matters in my talk. I know Mark's going to talk more about that. But I think one important difference is, I mean, I know very little about how the international drug trade is organized and how these people run their business. Though I suspect it's usually not along egalitarian lines. I would guess that most sort of large-scale drug runners, they're basically free market capitalists, and they run their business accordingly. They just happen to be illegal, but in every other respect, they're just like any other capitalist company. So I think one major difference why pirates and these smugglers in the Southeast may appeal to us is because they didn't organize themselves in those ways. They obviously made money through the capitalist world economy, but then they used that, the money they got, to build different social structures where they related along very egalitarian lines to each other. The tea smuggling business was obviously organized on an enormous scale, which this was not like sort of often you think of smugglers sort of sneaking around in like really quiet and muffled doors. This was not like this at all. Like often they would have 100, 200 people working at one landing. Now the gangs weren't this big, gangs were much smaller, so they would employ labor to help them transport the goods from the seaside and then up into the country. Now the wages they paid these laborers were enormous. In the hawkers gang in Kent, the wages they paid their laborers added up to just under £2 a night. Now an average English rural laborer at that time earned per year about £16. So working about 8 or 9 nights for the smugglers, these people would make as much as they normally would make in a whole year. And I can't see any sort of capitalist rationality why they would have paid such high wages. Smuggling was dangerous, but not that dangerous. It was hard work, but not that hard work. Labor wasn't particularly scarce in these areas. It wasn't that that drove up the price. So I really think there was a conception of a fair wage, a living wage, a dignified wage. And we know from studies that began with E.P. Thompson, his notion of the moral economy, that today when we think of market price, what we think of is what those mysterious laws of the market work out to be the price of a certain thing. What people in the 18th century meant when they said market price is what a loaf of bread should cost in the market, what they felt was a fair price. And I think these smuggling gangs had the same notion when they extended that to the labor they employed. They recognized that labor has a fair price and it has to be enormously, enormously high. So I think that's the difference between these smuggling gangs and modern drug smugglers. And I should also just add one final point. Not all English smugglers at the time were organized along these egalitarian lines. For example, I found evidence of East Anglian smugglers, where it basically was big farmers who told their indentured their servants to go and smuggle. And the laws that were passed in these years is very interesting. The laws were passed specifically that only the act of smuggling or the intention to physically smuggle, like it was enough to just have the intention, you didn't even have to commit the crime to be executed. Just another lovely aspect of it. But the point being, the way the laws were constructed, that if the farmer who sent off the servant was basically safe from prosecution, and even if he had his barn full of smuggled goods, he got a slap on the hand, a fine. It was only the act of smuggling, which was his servants, who would get executed. So this was the way smuggling was organized in some of the other regions. So it wasn't all smugglers that operated the way these southeastern ones did.
Just one quick point about this idea of modern-day drug smuggling. I mean, there's some interesting developments going on in Brazil. Obviously, I don't say either way what I think about it, but certainly in favelas, you know, the shanty towns surrounding big Brazilian cities, the drug smuggling is such a mass activity now that the drug smuggling gangs, again, I wouldn't claim to know how they're organised, but they're certainly starting to provide social services for people in the favelas. I mean, there's a lot of evidence now that the state does not provide a lot of those things, like healthcare, nurseries, schools, things like that. And in the favelas, drug gangs are actually organising on a fairly vast scale these kind of social services. They've almost become a state within a state. That's something to bear in mind, because I don't think it's as simple as saying, oh, there's some cocaine cartel making a load of money and they're just walking away. They recognise that they need the protection of the whole community, and you can get that protection in different ways. In the mafia, obviously, you know, there's levels of protection and those kind of relationships. But in Brazil, for example, I think the drug smugglers have realised that if the state doesn't provide these things, and they do have the money to provide them, if they do that, then they've gained the protection of the whole community. And if you've got the protection of the whole community, like the pool smugglers that Kevin was talking about on Monday, then you're in a much, much safer position to carry out your activities. So there are some modern day parallels.
Nicholas, can you say something about the companies that were providing the tea? How did they escape? How did they work under the radar? I mean, they'll be like quite visible.
They weren't under the radar. They were completely open. When East India company ships would come to China, they would sit in the same roads or harbour as these other ships from the, I don't know, Gothenburg company or Brandenburg company, and everyone involved knew that they were buying tea with the sole aim of then giving it to, or selling it to English smugglers. This was completely open, and it was partially, one thing that's interesting in this story, that some of these companies were actually funded by English capitalists who were pissed off about being excluded from the monopoly that the East India Company had. So they just took their money, went to Sweden, for example, and asked if they could set up an East Indian Trading Company in Gothenburg, and they would pay a little bit to the crown, and they would also see, and then this trade, of course, would also be in the interest of this place, because they would pay some customs duties, but these customs duties were far lower than the English customs duties. So this was completely open. I don't actually know to what degree the British government knew who exactly were these people were involved, and how they related to them. On the continental side, this was a completely open, legitimate business. The English smugglers were just buyers just like anyone else, except that Europeans didn't tend to drink much tea. So they pretty much were the only buyers of tea, but it was like open.
And how did they organize the distribution? Once they got the tea, they brought it ashore. How did they organize the distribution?
Okay. This is also a very interesting question, because modern day economic historians of this tea smuggling trade have argued, and in my estimation, however limited that is in economic history, convincingly, that the activities of the smugglers actually had a beneficial impact on the British economy, because they developed they helped the integration of the whole market and what's often called the commercial revolution of the 18th century. The East India Company found it very difficult to do, because by law the East India Company had to bring all tea to London first, and then wholesalers from all over England would have to come to the warehouse in London and there buy the tea and then bring it back. So it was a very, very cumbersome and difficult process. And you had to have buyers on different scales. So the people who went to London obviously had to buy in very, very large amounts, and then they sold to slightly smaller amounts. And so it was a very cumbersome process. These smugglers, they developed a system where they sold tea in very, very small amounts. And they had a whole army of tea traders, essentially, who would... there's some of these characters of people like opening their coats, and there's like watches and everything here. It basically worked like that. There were people who would fill their coats with small bags of tea and then just walk up to London and just like, tea anyone? And this was an enormous efficient system. The smugglers, they managed to bring tea into the smallest, most remote hamlets in upland Sussex. And this obviously... this is a sort of an ironic aspect of this whole story, that they clearly furthered the development of capitalist social relations in the rural south by furthering this sort of monetizing of the economy and furthering these exchange relations. So So the long-term effects were certainly not anti-capitalist in that sense, at least that part of their legacy. I think the sort of social part of it certainly was.
Yeah, if you have a look at the exhibition here, you'll find there's some really great cigarette cards, and you'll find some of the tub of men and the bat men and the people, all the different activities of the smuggling sort of trade going on. Outside the front, you'll see the people with the coats hiding and stuff, so have a look, it's all there. Maybe these more pressing questions. What we're going to do is, no more questions? Right, what we're going to do is we're going to have a 20 minute break, so if you want to get a tea or a coffee or a drink.
Tea,
maybe. Don't get too leery if you have too much. But yeah, 20 minutes.